I follow Michał's example and wish you a good morning, a good afternoon, and a good evening. And I call this session, this first session of the afternoon, the Polish session, because both speakers are of Polish origin. So this is exciting. And I see that we have handwritten transparencies. And this reminds me that Bartek, you gave a talk also in our last Tensor Network workshop where you actually gave a Blackboard presentation, right?
Yes, so I always give Blackboard talks whenever I can, and this is the best substitute I can in the era of Zoom.
Ah, super. Okay, so let's start with Bartek here, who talks about query complexity and cutoffs in ADS3 CFD2. Please start.
So thank you very much for having me speak here for the second time in a row in this great sequence of workshops. I'm very, very happy to be speaking here again. And the subject is query complexity, or more generally just complexity and cutoffs in the ADS3 CFD2 correspondence. So the subject is not inherently tensor networky, but I tried to emphasize the tensor networks aspect or philosophy in this talk, and hopefully if you feel that there are not enough tensor networks here, then please ask me questions at the end about how this relates to tensor networks, and hopefully I'll be able to answer. This work is mostly in progress, but there was also a Harbinger paper listed here, and it's done in collaboration with my students, Bo and Chen and Ziji Wang here in Tsinghua University in Beijing, and also with Lampros Lampru and Jan de Boer, who are probably more famous than my students. So complexity is the main subject, and I'm sure that even if you don't work in the ADS-CFT correspondence, you have heard about complexity, or about the idea that complexity is this quantity that we're supposed to be interested in addition to entanglement. When you study the ADS-CFT correspondence, you have a conformal field theory, which is supposed to describe entirely a gravitational theory which lives in one extra dimension. We typically draw ADS space as a cylinder. And so here is a cylinder, which is ADS space. The CFT is supposed to live on the asymptotic boundary of the cylinder. So that's the empty cylinder. And then the solid cylinder, including the interior, is empty de Sitter space. And that's where gravity happens. And it's interesting to look at various geometries in it. So here, this picture of a cylinder is one geometry we can look at, and I highlighted here an equal time slice of this empty de Sitter space, time flows upwards, which is also a Cauchy slice, which also marks a Cauchy slice for the dual conformal field theory, which lives on the asymptotic boundary on the empty cylinder. Here I have drawn a picture of another state that shows up in the ADS-CFT correspondence. This is an entangled state of two CFTs. We typically draw it in gravitational language as a Penrose diagram, but just in case it's not clear what this means, let me just say that here is one side of a black hole. Here's another side of a black hole. There are two asymptotic regions. Each of them asymptotically looks like the cylinder. And they are because the CFTs are in an entangled state, the bulk dual of this is not just an empty cylinder, but something that has a black hole inside it. And the interior of the black hole in this picture is living up and down. And this black hole is such that you can fall from it either from one cylinder or from the other cylinder. That's a two-sided black hole. And what I have drawn here is an equal time slice of such a geometry, first at this time, and then at some later time. And you notice that this equal time slice, I tried to draw it, is getting larger. And so there's a question that you can ask if you study the ADS-CFT correspondence, which is, we have these spatial slices of geometries, which at least when there is a black hole are growing in size. And then the question is, what does that mean from the CFT point of view? If ADS-CFT as a correspondence is true, then there must be some notion of something growing which reflects the growing spatial sizes of these spatial slices of the dual geometry. So what exactly is growing in the CFT, which corresponds to the growth of spatial sizes in ADS space? Now, you don't have to talk about growing things. So imagine that in this box, I just cut out the words growing. You can also ask, what does it mean that the spatial slice of this anti de Sitter space, that's not growing, that's staying constant. But what sets its value? That's another question that you can ask. And so generally we want to know what are spatial sizes in the bulk relative to in the language of the boundary CFT. And there is a proposal here by Susskind that these spatial sizes correspond to state complexities in the CFT. So when the spatial sizes are growing, the state complexity is growing in some sense. Now, that's a very nice proposal. And both a strength and a weakness of this proposal is that it is not well defined on either side. So there is so much flexibility for it that in some sense it has to be true when once you make it correct properly, once you make it precise in an appropriate way. But on the other hand, until you have done this, this statement is kind of meaningless. And here is where this is what I meant by drawing this. This is not supposed to be ADS space. This is supposed to be a glass which is half full, half empty. It is both a strength and a weakness of the proposal that it is not so terribly well defined. So how do we quantify spatial sizes is the not well definedness on the left-hand side. I say that these sizes are larger, but how are we going to quantify what large means? Are we going to compute volumes of spatial slices? This is the simplest thing you can do. Another option is you can take the region which is which is what's called the domain of dependence of this slice, and then you can ask how much volume is inside there, or maybe how much action. Now this object has the correct units to compute the action in it. How much action is inside it? This kind of region is called the Wheeler-DeWitt patch, and action in Wheeler-DeWitt patch is one of the other proposals in addition to volume of spatial slices for quantifying spatial sizes in ADS space. But there are also other proposals. This is not the only two. On the CFT side, there are many proposals for what we mean by the concept of state complexity. One thing is circuit complexity. So how do we make a state with a certain set of gates? Another notion is a distance in the Fubini study metric from the state to some other state, which is a reference state. Another one is path integral optimization. A lot of work done, especially by groups in Japan, like Tadashi Takayanagi's group and Pavel Caputa and others. I also happen to write one paper on path integral optimization. So there are at least three proposals, but in fact, there are many more for what state complexity might mean. Now, so I just have this slide here to introduce the subject and also to tell you that there is no consensus opinion about what spatial sizes in ADS and what state complexities in the CFT mean, even though there is a proposal that they should be the same thing. Now, I'm going to tell you about an entirely different notion of complexity, but before this, I have to say one more thing, which is that complexity depends on the cutoff in the conformal field theory. So let me tell you about why that has to be the case. And I'm saying this partly because the title of my talk is Complexity and Cutoffs, and they will be intimately related, not just in this talk, but in general, they are related. So let me tell you about why the subject of cutoffs is so important. So if we didn't have a cutoff, then the complexity would have to be infinite. That's the statement I want to make. Now, why? If I don't have a cutoff, then I have an exact conformal field theory without any scale specified. And a field theory which is conformal is one where all scales are related by a symmetry. That means that there is an infinite family of scales and all of them are on an equal footing. So no matter what you mean by complexity, if you're going to prepare a state, that's what complexity must mean, some kind of difficulty in preparing the state. If you're going to prepare a state, you will have infinitely many details to account for, the same amount of detail at every scale. So the answer would have to be infinite unless you cut off your state at some cutoff scale. And so this is the conclusion of this slide, that complexity is only well-defined after we specify a cutoff. In the language of ADS space, the presence of the cutoff is the fact that ADS space has spatial slices of ADS space have infinite volume, but only if we draw some kind of cutoff surface, can we extract a finite quantity out of this otherwise infinite volume? So the plan for today, I just told you how cutoffs are intimately related to any notion of complexity that you might want to attempt to give. Now, the plan for today is for me to tell you a completely new idea for what a cutoff means and for what state complexity means in the CFT. In fact, to tell this, I have to first start even at an even more basic level and tell you again about what a state is. And just to be clear about where this new approach is coming for, here I highlighted some things which are the logical starting points for this development. One is something called subregion duality. It's the idea that if I only know a piece of the CFT, then I only know a piece of the bulk ADS spacetime. And what piece I know is actually known in a great degree of detail. And that's something that will be a basic input for my reasoning. Another one is a concept called modular parallel transport, which is a notion of transport that takes density matrices to other density matrices. And it's something that is very natural from the bulk, from the ADS point of view. And it's a concept that my collaborators and I, especially Jan de Boer and Lambros Lampru and I, have developed in a fair degree of detail during the last 1 to 2 years. And another logical starting point, so I will be using this as an input for making precise my conceptualization of what a state, a cutoff, and what state complexity are. And finally, query complexity. Most proposals thus far have focused on a notion of complexity, which is either circuit complexity, I mentioned these other proposals. None of them were query complexity. So that's a concept of, or a type of complexity that makes sense for discussing algorithms in conformal field theory. And what I'm not in conformal field theory, in computer science. And what I want to tell you is that we should be really thinking of a state as an algorithm which takes operators as inputs and maps them into expectation values. If I think of this map, this is what the state should do. If I think of a state as a map which takes operators to expectation values, think about how you would evaluate this map. If there is some algorithm that evaluates it, then it would make sense to talk about the query complexity of that algorithm. I will make this a lot more precise in a moment. For now, I'm just explaining why this concept of query complexity, which is usually used for quantifying algorithms or characterizing algorithms, is actually applicable for talking about states, especially states at the cutoff. Now, I am giving this talk here at a conference focused on tensor networks because we are all familiar with one type of algorithm which shows up all the time for describing states in this way, as maps from operators to expectation values. This class of algorithms is called tensor networks. Tensor networks are algorithms which take operators to their expectation values. And I will remind you of this in a moment, but that should be clear for people who actually work on tensor networks. Okay, any questions at this point? This is the plan. And in a moment, I will start talking about the real content. Any questions right now? So maybe no questions. So, okay. So I just emphasized the philosophy that a state is a map from operators to expectation values. So imagine that I made a long list of all possible operators that I have available in my theory. It could be field theory. It could even be just quantum mechanics. And then I'm going to just put some number, which is an expectation value of the given operator in my state, and populating this table with numbers is what it means to give you the state. So if I had a state, it's really a complete list for all numbers that I would put here in the expectation value column for any given operator that you would have. But here's a question. How do we specify these numbers? They're in a generic theory, certainly in field theory, I will have infinitely many operators. So I can't just give you a state which is an infinite list of numbers. I have to be able to give you the state in some more concise form, which isn't just this table, right? So what should I do? Well, one way that I can do things is that I can say my state is only going to be defined at the cutoff. That cutoff would divide the operators into two classes, those which are sensitive to below the cutoff, so more ultraviolet the details of the state, and those which are not. And so by specifying a state, I could say the state at the cutoff is an answer to this, is a way of filling this table, but only for operators which are more infrared than the cutoff. Whereas the more detailed, the more fine-grained operators, I don't have to have numbers for them because they're below the cutoff. So one way that I could go about this is I can say my state, not a state in the fundamental theory, but a state at the cutoff would be an incomplete list of these expectation values, a list that's only populated for operators which are coarser than the cutoff scale. Yes, that's what's written over here. So a way to say it is that the cutoff would restrict the domain of this map from operators to expectation values. Now, what kinds of, now how do we in practice populate this list? If I have a list with some operators, how do I actually find these expectation values? I would say that there are two examples that are kind of canonical for doing things. One example, and these examples are going to illustrate that I should be thinking of a state as an algorithm. So one example is, let's say, the vacuum in conformal field theory. Now this state is specified by the conditions that free operators, L minus one, L zero, and L plus one, all annihilate the state. So I can use those symmetries to constrain the quantities that would show up here. And in fact, these constraints are so powerful that they uniquely tell me that, for example, two-point functions, so expectation values of bilocal operators have to take this form in a conformal field theory. They also uniquely specify up to a certain constant, a three-point function, a trilocal operator. They also specify the structure of four-point functions and higher point functions in a special way, which many of us have read, for example, in Di Francesco or your favorite textbook on conformal field theory. So when those textbooks compute correlation functions of operators in the vacuum, they are populating this table, but they're populating this table by using special properties, which are the symmetries of the state they are describing. That's an okay way of proceeding, but it doesn't generalize to states which do not have special symmetries. So this is really a trick. It's a trick which is very powerful for states which admit a trick. But many states will not be amenable to this trickery. And so we have to have a different method of representing them. So what's another example of how we populate our table of operators and expectation values? My other example is exactly the subject of this workshop, which is tensor networks. And so think of a tensor network. Here I just drew the Mera tensor network just to make contact with this example, but it could be any tensor network. Think of this tensor network as a map, again, that takes operators to real numbers. Before I inserted these operators in this layer, I just have a state, which is the ket and the bra. And all I have to do is put in those operators and contract all indices in the resulting objects. And if the states were given by a complete tensor network, then these numbers are going to, this thing is going to evaluate to some number. And that number is exactly the number I would put here for the given operator. And so a tensor network is very visibly a map from operators to their expectation values, but it is also an algorithmic way of actually computing the entries in that table. You give me an operator, and one by one, I can just keep contracting indices in these tensors, contracting these tensors until I arrive at the final answer. And once I have an answer, I will put it in this place in the table. And so a tensor network is a little more than just a description of the state. It is also giving me a specific algorithm for computing entries in the table for any given input operator. And this thinking of a tensor network as an algorithm is going to be very important for my philosophy about complexity. Are there any questions or comments about that? Again, I'm assuming no, but I encourage you to ask questions. So here is the philosophy that I have. I want to take what's salient about tensor networks and generalize it just ever so slightly to come up with a slightly more flexible notion of complexity than people have considered before. So here is what, and that kind of complexity is called query complexity. So what is query complexity for an algorithm? It answers the question, how many times the given algorithm calls some particular key subroutine, which is assumed to be the bottleneck for the execution of the algorithm. So if I think of a tensor network as my quintessential algorithm or of my paradigmatic algorithm, then the basic subroutines that we, okay, so a tensor network is an algorithm for computing correlation functions. The basic subroutine in this algorithm is just tensor contraction. Now, if I apply the notion of query complexity for this, with this identification of what a key subroutine is tensor contraction, then query complexity is just the number of tensor contractions that I have to do when I actually evaluate the algorithm on some input operators. And so if I use the concept of query complexity to characterize the special class of algorithms, which are tensor networks, then my complexity will be the number of tensor contractions. Maybe if I, instead of tensor contraction, I would just say a single tensor, then maybe I'm just counting tensors. But one way or the other, I'm counting some extensive quantity, which is extensive with respect to the tensor network. And that's what query complexity is. So in my talk, the goal is to generalize slightly the notion of counting tensors. And what I'm assuming is that this concept of query complexity is the key to, hopefully the key to the right notion of complexity, which is relevant to the holographic duality. But I do not want to presume that I always have a state given in the form of a tensor network. And I don't want to always presume that the algorithm I have at hand is actually a tensor network. I want to be a little more flexible in thinking about what the subroutine will be and what class of algorithms there will be, but I still want to use query complexity for quantifying complexity. So that's my philosophy here.
Bartek?
And I just want to say that this philosophy is a natural generalization of why people proposed at least the volume proposal. So remember the proposal that maybe complexity is dual to volumes of spatial slices in ADS space. Well, when Susskind and others proposed this as a hypothesis for what complexity would be in the bulk, what they envisioned is that a bulk slice of the dual ADS spacetime is actually filled by some tensor network. And they said the complexity should be volume because the complexity is about counting tensors. Notice that notion of counting tensors is exactly query complexity. So when they were proposing that volume should be related to complexity, they were really implicitly implying the notion of query complexity for a very particular subroutine, which is tensor contraction. So I want to be faithful to that philosophy, but not make a commitment to tensor networks as a particular class of algorithms. Are there any questions or comments about that?
Yes, Bartek, there's a question from Luca Tagliacozzo to everyone. Are you interested in local operators or generic operators?
Generic operators. And so here an operator could be some non-identity. So let's say that I have write down all possible multi-local operators. Yeah, an example of an operator could be a five-point operator. So its expectation value would be a five-point correlator in the CFD. There would be one non-trivial piece that acts here, maybe an identity there, another non-trivial piece here, there will be five non-trivial pieces, and everything else would be identities for that specific example. But in general, the class of operators that I would put here is just anything at all at this point. Any questions? Any other questions? Later, so I should say that so far I just explained what, other questions?
Yeah, there's a question by Johannes Knauter.
Uh-huh. Yeah, one more question. So I can imagine if you increase the bond dimension or like the physical dimension of your Mera tensors, for example, you kind of put scale up arbitrarily your query complexity. So do you want to include such a feature? Or?
I have multiple answers to this question. One is that we're really mostly interested in the scaling properties. So increasing the bond dimension would be just some overall scale, and I wouldn't think of this as something that realistically should be extractable from this treatment. It all depends on what I call a subroutine. Is a subroutine a contraction of a single tensor or a group of four neighboring tensors? So that's one answer. And another thing is that I actually will not be telling you about an algorithm which is a tensor network. Or at the very end, I will tell you that it is a tensor network, but it will be a detour. So that question is kind of, it will not be terribly relevant for the rest of what I want to say. Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Johannes. Someone is raising their hand.
Can you please, thank you. Please continue, Bartek.
Okay, so good. So let's construct. So the first thing we have to do, and I forgot to say, in this slide, I just told you about my philosophy, but this slide doesn't say anything about the cutoff. Remember, the cutoff is very important because without the cutoff, any complexity is going to be infinite. So I'm going to tell you how to construct a state, but there will be a key feature to my proposal, which is that state has to be faithful, or it has to reflect the properties of the assumed cutoff. That will be the guiding principle for defining a state in the particular way that I will do that. And then we can, at the end of the day, when I give you what the state, I believe what it should be, then we can discuss whether this is a tensor network or not. In some sense it is, but I'm not going to assume that it is a tensor network, but I will take seriously one extra input, which is currently not displayed on this slide, which is the input about the cutoff. So let's do that. So here is an example of the kind of algorithm that I have on mind, which is, suppose that I am working in the vacuum of a conformal field theory. I'm starting from this example because it's a well understood example, but I'm going to describe the vacuum not in its entirety, but only at a certain scale. Now that scale in the ADS language would correspond to some radial slice of the bulk, which skirts some constant radial, which stays at some constant radial depth. So maybe for people who are not terribly familiar with ADS CFT, let me explain that the picture that I have drawn here is like a piece of an equal time slice of ADS spacetime. It would be like this slice over here. I'm taking the ground state, which is time, which is invariant under time translation. So I'm going to ignore completely the time direction, and I'm just going to draw what this spatial slice looks like. And when I draw it, it looks like this. And here I focused on a very small piece of that spatial slice. So locally, I'm drawing my circle as a line, and this is my cutoff surface. It hovers at some constant radial slice inside ADS space, and that's what the cutoff is. So I want to say, how would we compute the correlation functions in this state? Well, correlation functions in this state should depend on, remember the slide when I said that the cutoff constrains or restricts the domain of the map from state to operators? That's just a more slightly more fancy way of saying that I don't need to compute correlation functions of all operators. They just have to be operators defined at a certain scale. Holographically, this is a statement that the operators should localize just on that cutoff surface. And so here is one operator, and here is another operator. And what I should be doing is computing their correlation functions. If I do that, then I'm done. And so what I have done here is I have given you an unfamiliar way of computing such correlation functions, which is particularly nice for the task at hand, for being faithful to this cutoff. In this way of computing correlation functions, I'm only ever doing things at the cutoff, never venturing below it, and never using the physics, which is more UV than my cutoff. And I'm also never venturing to the more IR than the cutoff itself. I'm just staying on the cutoff. I will explain to you what I mean by this. So the philosophy of this computation is, let me scan the cutoff. Imagine traveling along the cutoff. And as I travel, I ask the question, is there some operator which I should be computing a correlation function for? And if there is, good, I take it. If not, I just keep moving on until I find another one. So all throughout, I am scanning the cutoff surface for potential input operators. And when I have them, I take them. If not, I keep going. So to do this, I have to know what it means to scan my cutoff surface. In the particular case, and this is the nice thing about this example, I know exactly what operator does this from the CFT point of view. A translation which sort of goes horizontally about such cutoff surface is generated by an operator, which is L minus one times dx. Why do I say dx? Because I should have a notion of translation, which is infinitesimal. And then combining such infinitesimal translations would allow me to make finite translations. But the thing I should be able to have is an infinitesimal translation, and that's L minus one times dx. So here's how my calculation proceeds. I start from the vacuum. This is the full vacuum of the full CFT. And I'm just going to move along my cutoff, which is what this exponential of L minus one dx does. This is a finite translation which takes me from infinity up until here. I hit this place and I see, oh, there is an input, O one. And I keep going to the next input. How do I go there? By making another finite translation from x one to x two. I have another input, and then I keep going all the way to infinity. And at that point, I contract with a Bra vacuum. Notice that when I apply this finite translation to O zero, to the vacuum is actually invariant under these translations. So this thing acts as if it was never there. Then I have an O one, then I have a finite translation from the location of X one to the location of X two. That's what I have here. And over here, I have the second input. And then I have the next Wilson line, but this Wilson line again, this finite translation again, annihilates the vacuum except for the identity piece. So I end up only with this thing. Now this translation here essentially puts this O1 in the place O1 evaluated at the difference between their locations. And now I'm left with just the computation of the two-point function in the more traditional way, and it gives me the right answer. So you see how my computation of correlation functions can be recast in the form of following the cutoff surface, taking inputs, and keeping scanning, following the cutoff surface until I take in more inputs. And at the end, the answer is just the correlation that I want. The key thing that is important in this slide is that I was able to write my correlation this way because I knew what it means to scan the cutoff surface. In this case, scanning the cutoff surface was done by the operator valued one form, which is L minus one dx. It's a one form because integrals of it should give me finite transformations. It's an operator valued one form because it should give me a transformation. So that explains why it is this kind of mathematical structure. And in a general cutoff, if my cutoff wasn't this nicely behaved cutoff, which is this example, and if my state wasn't the vacuum, then I would be able to do the same job, but I need to know what it means, what I should replace L minus one dx with. And that object, whatever it is, I'm going to call ds dds. Dds is like the L minus one part. It's the operator valued part. And the ds is the one form part. So it's an operator valued one form. If I have an operator valued one form that allows me to follow the cutoff, then I'm in business. And so the next three or four slides are going to be about the construction of this operator valued one form. Any questions at this point? Okay, so let me continue scanning, constructing the algorithm. I said scanning the cutoff, but actually constructing the algorithm. So excuse me. So what I just said a moment ago is that if we can find such an operator, then we will have an algorithm. And the way the algorithm will work will be exactly the way that it did before, except that wherever I had this finite translation in this slide, I have replaced it with a path ordered exponential of some unknown A, and that A plays the role of DSDDS, of scanning the cutoff. So these things, the path ordered exponentials, are finite translations along the cutoff surface. I take in an operator, and I go along the cutoff surface, take another operator. This thing is doing exactly the same thing as what we did in the previous slide for the vacuum, except now it is done for a general state, assuming that I know how to write such an A. So the question is, how do I construct such an A? Okay. And it's at this point that I want to say that the input about the cutoff is going to be important. So first of all, to find A is a translation along the cutoff. So I have to be very careful about finding my A so that it's precisely matching and fine-tuned for the notion of the cutoff that I have. And the second comment I want to make here is about operator inputs. So I don't need to, and I don't want to evaluate correlation functions for operators that live below or above this cutoff surface. They should be right there on the cutoff surface. Only those are the operators at the right scale for which the state should give me my correlation functions. So is there some condition for selecting just the operators that live here? And this is the input about subregion duality. Subregion duality tells me that if I have an operator of a given size, if I have an interval of a given size, such as this one, then the operators which commute with the modular Hamiltonian, so minus the logarithm of this row, are exactly the ones that live on this, the boundary of this, on this geodesic, which I can draw through the bulk. The statement that an operator lives on the cutoff surface means that the operator should simultaneously commute with rho, but it should also commute with rho prime, the derivative of rho as I'm moving along the operator. As I'm moving along the cutoff surface, if you think about it for a moment, you will see that this condition, which I spelled out here, is exactly the condition for my input operators to be just the localized on the cutoff surface. And that's the kind of operators that I will assume will be playing the role of inputs in this calculation. And I know this from subregion duality. Remember I mentioned that my logical and starting points will be blah, blah, blah. That's one of them, subregion duality, and it's happening right here. Any questions or comments about that? Okay, so let me tell you about, so this is what the algorithm has to look like, but I still haven't told you anything about how to construct A. And so for A, for the construction of A, I need two inputs. One of them I mentioned before explicitly, which is modular parallel transport. And so my collaborators and I, Jan de Boer and Lampros Lampro, gave us a definite characterization of what it means to map this region in the bulk to this region in the bulk in a very particular way. That very particular way is such that this point here is mapped to itself. So if the two geodesics, which are incident on a given interval, if the two geodesics have a common endpoint, then that common endpoint has to map to itself. If you think about this, this is a very special condition. If you ask me, how do I map in whatever is sitting inside the dark green line to whatever is sitting inside the light green line, this point could have been mapped here or here or anywhere. There's a very special map which will map this region to the other region such that this point is staying fixed under the map. And that kind of map is called modular parallel transport. So the key thing that we have done in this paper is to give a, I mean, this is a condition that you can just specify in the bulk, But we told you exactly what kind of operator in the conformal field theory would do exactly this job, would do exactly the job of keeping this operator fixed. In other words, for instance, this point would exactly move here and not someplace else under this map. And so we know how to do this. Notice that this modular parallel transport is not doing the job that we want. We would like to map this point over here because we would like to slide along the cutoff surface. When I do this thing, the operator, modular parallel transport, this point is actually mapping here, not there. So I'm not sliding along the cutoff surface. I'm actually rolling along the cutoff surface, not sliding. But it's a start. So let me just say that my A, whatever it is going to be 1 plus IDV. IDV, 1 plus IDV is the finitized transformation generated by DV. But then there's going to be another piece which will actually map this point, which is where the point X ended up after modular parallel transport, back to where it needs to be, which is back on the cutoff surface. So 1 plus A is going to be this times something else, and it's the something else that we have to find. Now the something else, now mapped in the marked in orange, has to map this point to this point. Whatever it is a motion along the cutoff surface. In other words, it takes operators which commute with the modular Hamiltonian for this interval to other operators which commute with the modular Hamiltonian of this interval. Therefore, it itself must commute with the modular Hamiltonian. In other words, it must be what's called a zero mode of the modular Hamiltonian. It's something that will commute with this next row, and that's what I have here. Do we know how to find this operator? So the answer is yes, we know. I don't have time to talk about it in detail, but let me just tell you that it's a quantity, which it's an object, which can be completely determined from DV, from the content of the previous slide. And because I know what DV is for as a CFT object, therefore I also know what this thing is as a CFT object because it's derived from it. In a certain technical construction, I can think of this quantity here as being acceleration if the content of the previous slide, if these arrows represented a type of velocity, then this would be acceleration. I don't have time to explain this statement, but if you are interested in it, then please contact me after the talk or privately, and I'll be very happy to expand on it. But the takeaway from this slide is that both the piece we had on the previous slide and the new piece, the orange arrow here, are things that we exactly know how to explicitly construct in the CFT language. Therefore, we know how to do sliding along the cutoff in the CFT language. And so that's what I wanted to establish. So now that we know how this A is constructed, we know how to slide along the cutoff, I can go back to this formula here and I say, this is my state. And now nothing is unknown. It's just this A, what's sitting here is just this A, which I just told you how to construct. But in fact, we can massage this expression a little more. And to massage it, I want to tell you one more thing, which is that when I take, when I conjugate a density matrix for one of these regions whose geodesics are tangent to the cutoff surface, if I take one of such regions and their density matrix is rho, and if I conjugate it by the Wilson line, by some Wilson line of this A, then I will get another row for another interval, which is also tangent to the cutoff. So an example of this is that I could have taken this row 2, conjugated by the Wilson line that takes me from here to here, and out would pop the row for this region. Okay, and this follows from these properties, which are the properties that I just explained to you on the previous slides. Because of this, I can simplify my algorithm in a drastic way. So here is just a rewriting of what the algorithm was doing. But I want to say that when I take this row, well, maybe let me start with this one. When I take this O2, it is actually conjugated by Wilson lines that take this O2 and map it over to here. So O2 may be acting at this point, but O2 conjugated by these guys is actually acting someplace on the boundary of this row. Now I have this O1, which is also something that acts on the boundary of this row. So in fact, in the way I wrote this expression, everything is happening in the Hilbert space on which row one is defined. O2 is an operator which acted here, but it's been transported to act on row one. O1 already acts on row one. And I still have these other Wilson lines which take the outer product formed from the state, the state as a matrix. But then I have to have a trace. At this point, the trace is acting on expressions which are all defined on this interval. So I might as well take the trace over the complement of row one first. And this thing will boil down to just being row one or some row. Conjugated by these Wilson lines, this is actually a density matrix for row one. And so instead of writing this more lengthy expression trace and outer product of these Wilson lines, I might as well have just started from some fiducial density matrix and put the Wilson lines constructed from O in between my inputs. And this is the way I want to describe my state. So the final answer for what the state is this expression. I have some row at some beginning little interval whose incident geodesic is tangent to my cutoff surface. And then I have a combination of one plus A, that's an infinitesimal translation, and I'm reading an input. One plus A to go to the next location and another input. One plus A to go to the next location and another input. And I have just a sequence of all these things. And by the time I scan the entire cutoff surface, then I form a trace. This is my map from operators to expectation values. And the operator inputs are marked here in these blue ellipses. Okay. Notice that this thing is given in the form of an algorithm, just like I said. It's an algorithm which is entirely constructed in the CFT language. I'm quite proud of this because typically when people talk about complexity, they either start from the bulk side and talk about volumes or actions and will-of-the-width patches, but then it's really difficult to connect with any notion of complexity in the CFT. Or people start from presupposed notions of complexity in the CFT, but then it's difficult generally to make contact with the bulk. Here I started from an input in the bulk in the form of the cutoff surface, but I gave you the algorithm, which is on a completely firm and precise footing in the CFT language. But it knows about the bulk cutoff, but it's defined in the CFT. This is the thing that's key about it. And it depends crucially on the construction of this, my ability to slide through the cutoff and read off inputs. Okay, so now can we compute or can we quantify the complexity of this algorithm? This is where we make some contact with tensor networks. So I wanna say, here's my state. And remember my state to compute its or to quantify its query complexity, I was supposed to count some subroutines. What's a repeatedly used subroutine in this algorithm? The answer is it's obviously this object. It's something that reads off an input and translates to the next location on the cutoff surface. I will be doing it again and again, reading off an input, translating to the next location on the cutoff surface, reading off an input and translating along the next cutoff surface. So if I want, I could represent this state as a matrix product state like that, which is initialized by one of these reduced density matrices for a tangent region. But then after that, I'm using the same tensor over and over to make something like an MPS state, except it was initialized here. And the operator inputs are the free legs that are coming into this matrix product state. And so counting my query complexity should be counting either these operators or how hard it is to perform the job of these operators. That's what query complexity should be. So in the next slide, I'm going to tell you what I propose to be a query complexity for this specific kind of algorithm. But before I do this, I just want to make sure that everybody's on the same page about this conclusion, which is relevant, especially to this workshop. I presented the state, which is supposed to be a bulk state defined at some bulk cutoff, entirely in the CFT language. And when we have it in the CFT language, we look at it and we recognize it actually is a matrix product state, except for the extra row infinity, which is sitting there. It's exactly a matrix product state. Okay, so now let's just say I have, I think, one or two more slides about what the query complexity of that really should be. Before this, one remark, motivating remark for that question is that let's think about what the subroutine which makes the matrices in the matrix product state, what it's doing. It's taking one of these regions to another one of these regions whose geodesics are tangent to the cutoff surface. So it's taking one of them to another and it's taking an input. It just does these two jobs. It maps what's called one entanglement wedge, cutoff size entanglement wedge to the another, and it reads off an input operator. So what should be the query complexity? We are all familiar, I think we have all seen the idea that the entire CFT should be thought of as some tensor network. In that case, the job of this A, of this sliding, corresponds to, remember, it's supposed to map me from one such region to the next one, to the next one. So the idea is that I'm supposed to take one of these regions to the next one. The job of A is somehow quantified by whatever is sitting in my complete tensor network in this little wedge and in this little wedge. Yes? I hope you can agree that the difficulty of performing that job should be proportional to the angle which is defining these wedges. These wedges are all isomorphic to each other because ADS space is a, well, at least under reasonable, they are largely identical to each other. Let me just leave it at that. Except for one thing, they're characterized by this little width. And so essentially the only thing that can characterize meaningfully how difficult it is to apply A or to distinguish various A's from another is how wide this wedge is, this wedge and the wedge. One of them I have to cancel, the other one I have to add if I want to move one of these regions to the next region in the cutoff, in the tensor network. So I want to say that there is essentially a unique metric in the space of density matrices, which is consistent with the heuristics that we just spelled out. On a very technical level, this metric is called the Kirilov-Tonstan-Suryo metric for the Sjöqvist connection A. But I'm certainly not going to go to that level of rigor and mathematical detail to talk about it. Suffice it to say that that metric basically evaluates to just the width of these wedges if I think about what A is doing in this pictorial fashion. Now, think about this. The metric is supposed to be proportional to this angle here, but what is that angle? These geodesics are fixed by the condition that they are tangent to the cutoff surface. Whatever angle I'm making here is exactly the angle by which the curve, if I was following it, actually kind of bent, yes? So if you think about this, the only quantity that this can be in the bulk is proportional to the extrinsic curvature of the cutoff surface times the distance in the bulk. So I just gave you lots of words and lots of rationalization for a very simple statement. The only notion of query complexity, which is consistent with our heuristics, is the one that when you evaluate it in the bulk, is actually the density of extrinsic, not the density, the extrinsic curvature of the cutoff surface itself. Now, if that's the case, then complexity itself is an integral of this along the cutoff surface. Remember, the cutoffs, our algorithm functions by scanning the cutoff surface. And as I scan it, I am paying a complexity price, which is proportional to this. If I scan all along it and come back to where I started, I'm going to take a closed integral of this object KDS. And I say that this is what query complexity is from the bulk point of view. It's the integral of the extrinsic curvature of the cutoff surface in our bulk 2+1 dimensions. If we are in a general geometry, then this is the full answer and there's nothing more to say. But in pure ADS, I can use the Gauss-Bonnet theorem to evaluate it or to recast it in a different language. The Gauss-Bonnet theorem allows me to recast this as minus R, the bulk R, times the volume inside the region that I have, that the cutoff surface has enclosed. And so what I just got is a quantity proportional to the volume. So our query complexity in pure ADS actually reproduces Susskind et al.'s volume proposal. In other contexts, however, when R is not constant in the bulk, this quantity is not just going to be proportional to volume. So we are not reproducing the volume proposal in general, but we are reproducing it in a very special case, which is the best studied case, which also played a large role in their motivations for proposing it in the first place. And so here is a summary of the talk. On a qualitative level, I say that, I mean, here is a qualitative summary. And the query complexity, as I have defined it, will end up in 2+1 dimensions, evaluating to the integral of the extrinsic curvature of the cutoff surface along itself, along the full cutoff surface. And whatever it is, it gives some measure of spatial slice. It's not always equal to volume. It is almost never, I think, equal to the action of the Wheeler-DeWitt patch. But those were just proposals. They were very good and important proposals. But here's another proposal for some way of quantifying the size inside the cutoff surface. And so it's some measure of spatial size, even though it is different from the previously proposed sizes. But on a qualitative level, it is just as good as the volume or the Wheeler-DeWitt patch proposal. But it has one essential advantage over these other proposals. It is a completely well-defined proposal on the CFT side, in the sense that we have a state defined at the cutoff, which is entirely defined in the CFT language, and we know exactly what kind of complexity we're talking about, which is this query complexity. And so I think this is why I say I declare success in this project. And that's all I have to say for today, and thank you very much. I welcome questions.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bartek, for this really interesting talk and this notion of complexity that you introduce and the way how to define it and actually compute it, right? Which is very nice. Right. Are there questions to Bartek?
Now that I've finished, I'm going to have some wine. Cheers.
Wow. Okay. Wait for the question.
It's 10 p.m. here, so it's definitely wine time.
Okay, I think you had already some questions during the talk. And I think that further discussions could be performed in the Slack channels that we have. So you have your own personal Slack channel, and I'm sure that people will put in questions there and comments.
Okay. Thank you very much. And
thank you very much also for staying so late and giving.
Oh, not at all. Thank you so much.
And enjoy your wine.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bartek. Bye-bye.